We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling. Hi, everybody.
I'm Nick Kane.
And I'm Lauren Bailey.
And thanks for listening. We are now into our fourth podcast, Lauren, which means our fourth month. And through continued support, our network is absolutely growing. It's just great to see on Facebook and Twitter people contacting us. And
we're now up on iTunes.
We are up on iTunes. So you can now type in The Act of Storytelling to iTunes and you'll get to see all the previous episodes available for download. So the other thing we have to talk about is please, please, please review us on iTunes. Giving us a great review gets us noticed in iTunes, Lauren. And also, let's be honest, it only takes a second to give us 5 stars.
And we'd love your feedback to hear what you're liking, what you think we should be doing more of. So we normally talk a little bit before the podcast about where, you know, we've both been at, what auditions and classes we've been up to, goals, etc. And this month we were chatting off air before recording about what's been happening, and we realise that there's a bit of a common theme for both of us at the moment.
Yeah.
And it is this idea of being enough for ourselves, being enough for the work. So we have decided to dedicate this month's podcast to the idea of mindset. Hmm. With that in mind,
well played.
What have you been up to this month, Nick?
Yeah, well, Lauren, it's been a pretty interesting month for me. I mean, it's been full of plenty of soul searching, to be honest. The last podcast was actually part of a catalyst that happened in my life where I was actually getting ready for an audition and I'd found that I'd become quite disillusioned with my work as an artist. Without going into the nitty-gritty of it, Lauren, I'd rehearsed with you after we recorded last month, and despite some really great help from you, I'd started to lose confidence in what I was doing. And I guess I was starting to question the essence or the validity of my abilities. And soon after that, everything started to crash to the ground for me a little bit. Like, I found a real frustration with my position in the industry, and it took me a little while to figure out where all this came from. One of the hardest things for me always, Lauren, is in my journey as a storyteller and artist, is my mindset and this idea that you're not enough. So, I mean, it ate me alive for a couple of weeks, and no matter how many people tell you, hey, you're a great actor, hey, no, you are enough, this is fantastic.
You've got to find it within yourself.
Yeah, you don't hear it. I mean, your own insecurities drown out people's nice positive things that they say about you. So I had to really dig deep and draw a line in the sand this month. And, you know, I think everyone suffers from it in some form, but I am lucky enough that I've got a fantastic support network around me. Even this podcast is a part of that, you know, and I'm slowly starting to change that conversation in my head. And it took me a while to figure out the root of the problem. So I was putting way too much pressure on myself and I was being unreasonable with the pressure. Expecting to perform and to open myself up as a character and to feeling is almost impossible when you've got that much pressure on yourself.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to get lost in all of the things you should be doing and then you find out you're not actually connecting to yourself anymore.
Correct, yeah, exactly. And, you know, walking into an audition and feeling like you're doing something wrong or feeling like you're not enough is a horrendous way to go into an audition. So, I mean, the second part of the month I was fortunate enough where I went through a series of callbacks, some voiceover callbacks from an international cartoon.
That's exciting.
What was exciting about it? The audition was exciting, yes, but I actually went into those auditions and just said, let it go. Go in there, have fun. That's what it's about. You know, that's why you do it. It was transformational for me. Like, it really was. I actually loved that audition process and I came out of there feeling a lot better than I ever had at an audition process before. So, you know, I'm not saying I'm completely out of the woods with all this because I think it's something that will continue to come, you know, throughout my career is the way to describe
I think it's interesting. So many artists that you do talk to go through a bit of a cycle of this and you do go down before you come up, which is kind of really important, because when you're down there, you're sort of reaffirming why we're doing this in the first place. Correct. And when you come out of it, you're remembering what your strengths are.
Yeah.
And feeling positive. Yes, well, it's interesting to hear you talk about what you've been working through, because I've, you know, had a few up and down moments recently.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'm looking at this year is how to try to stay more consistently positive and motivated,
yeah,
you know, or as much, yeah, as possible. And I've been working with a good friend of mine who's also a talented actress. You know her, Andrea McKinnon. And she suggested to me this idea of gratitude and abundance in our lives. And just changing your perspective from, oh, where am I going? How do I get what I want to be happening into my life, and all of that, and actually going, well, so much of what we want is already around us, and let's start from a point of gratitude. So she suggested that we contact each other each day with three things that we're grateful for. And I counted that with, let's start with one, just to get this habit in place.
One thing that we're grateful for, or one?
Yeah, each, yep, day.
Wow.
And that kind of sounds easy.
It does. It sounds easy,
think,
right?
One thing.
Yeah.
It's actually been really interesting. Some days it feels genuinely hard to find something to be grateful for, which is ridiculous in a way, because, you know, I feel so lucky to live the life that I live, to have the opportunities that I have, you know, live in the house I live in.
Well, that's where you pitch your mindset, isn't it?
Yeah,
you
exactly. Know,
when you look at it,
and that's what relative. That's exactly the point. So on days where it's hard to go, oh, on a surface level, what am I grateful for? You can fall back on, I have a family who loves me. I'm able-bodied.
You know, all these things.
Can afford to buy myself a nice cup of coffee in the morning.
Most of the time, yeah.
Most of the time. But anyway, yeah, that's been really interesting, and it's that's great. Sort of an ongoing process for me.
It's interesting that you have to actually make time to do this, but it is so important, isn't it? Like, I do this myself, where you've got to make time to think about what you're happy with as well, because if you don't make time, you can get into this mindset.
Well, it's become this nice thing, you know, at the end of each day, it's like, oh, that's right, we send each other that text. And then, you know, you look back, it makes you look back over your day and find the positives in it. So it's actually been really powerful so far. And it's linked into some other realizations that I've been having about where I'm at in my life. And that it's not this idea of, when I get that job, I'll feel this way, or when I do well in this audition, that'll prove this to me. It's like, oh, what I'm doing now, this is it. And I just need to enjoy where I'm at now. So
it's a powerful message, isn't it?
It's been pretty exciting. I read an article on Backstage.com recently by Anthony Mindel, and he was talking about something similar to this, about how the measure of leading a successful life is about committing to what you want to be doing, and that's all, just committing to it, and the rest follows. He said something better than that. Anyway, I think
all these things sound very easy in theory, don't they? But it's the application of these things.
But he says some great stuff, and I actually think the actor's process, Claire Dia, who we worked with in Ale's workshop, she interviews him in her upcoming talk show, so hopefully he'll say something about it then, or I'm sure you'll say some other great stuff.
Yeah, it was interesting. Claire, after the workshop, was actually talking about what made her start the actor's process, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But she was saying that she wanted to create that sense of community for actors and a resource for everyone. So I guess everything that we're talking about here.
Yeah, about the support networks you were saying. And I keep talking to people, this theme of community comes up.
Things like this, the actor's process, the act of storytelling, they're all things to help with your mindset as well, for you to listen to, a community to help you and be positive. So all good things, Lauren, but we should
all
get
very
out.
Warm and fuzzy.
I know, we should get out of our wallowing and talking and speak to an actor.
Yes, and this month we had the good fortune to interview the lovely and hilarious Lulu McClatchy. Now, I originally met Lulu working on Anna O'Donnell's Pickett's Charge in 2012. Lulu has had a great career so far, working across the board from theatre to film, TV, online. She writes her own work, creates her own characters, including a super character. A super character called Supergirly, which she's been performing around the world. And we're about to find out all about it in the interview, so I won't go into more detail here, except to say that Supergirly, The Return of the Pop Princess, opens at Chapel Off Chapel this month, and it's going to be awesome. I Okay, so we're here today with storyteller Lulu McClatchy in her rehearsal studio. Very atmospheric. How long have you been rehearsing here, Lulu?
We've been here now, I think, about a month.
Yeah.
We were looking for somewhere to rehearse, and then my parents were closing down their lighting shop. So we went, what's happening with that back room that's empty?
Yeah.
So now I've set up in here, and it's sort of fine until the customers come in and start browsing, and then we keep stopping and going, hi. No, don't worry about me. I'm just standing here with my arm up. Really weird.
Yeah. Certainly going to be a bright show, isn't it?
Yeah,
with
it
all
is.
The lights around. Yeah.
These chandeliers certainly add a nice aspect to the feel of
the
space.
Well, they sort of they suit our set anyway, and we've sort of picked out which ones we want to use in the show.
Yeah.
And go, we'll have that one and that one.
And so can I say your dad's made signs. This amazing sign
I
as
know.
Well for the show.
Yes, Jeff's been very busy with his... He's actually dying to see the show, but every time he comes down we stop because he's one of those people that will tell everybody every detail. So we, and he keeps bringing people down and turning on the light and showing them the set, and I'm like, that's not what you're meant to be doing.
You're like, that's embargoed, Dad. You've got to hold on to that.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, we'd love you to tell us a little bit about your story. So, Lulu, when you're ready.
Oh, here's one I prepared earlier.
Great.
Okay. I actually can't remember ever wanting to do anything else besides perform. Singing and acting were always something I've done, and directing and producing and writing, and hair and makeup came later, out of necessity, really, trying to create my own work or having something else to do while waiting for the next audition. I didn't really realise the possibilities that the industry holds or what can be accomplished until I left Australia, unfortunately, isn't that sad, and went to the UK. I travelled overseas, had the opportunity to reinvent myself and try things that I hadn't had the guts to do here in front of my peers, and it was very invigorating, especially when it works out, which it did. I was lucky enough, or maybe I should say worked hard enough, to be able to realise my dreams. Working overseas, I worked on the BBC doing my own sitcom. I hosted shows on ITV and Channel 4, doing sketch shows with celebrities and touring the UK, USA and Canada with my own show. And now coming back to Australia and having to almost start again, that's where I really had to find out how dedicated I was.
That's fantastic. So you're obviously a very multi-talented and very accomplished storyteller.
Jack of all trades, isn't it? Master of none.
Let's just call you Jack. So, Jack, well, let's begin at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up in Melbourne?
Yes. I grew up in Melbourne and pretty much worked here right until I was in my 20s, and then I went to Sydney for a while and then came back before I went overseas.
Yeah. Did you like Sydney?
I didn't mind Sydney for work, but no, yeah. I couldn't live there for any length of time. It's a very, everyone sort of seems very transient, like they're just there for whatever they're doing and then they go. It's not as relaxed and easy to live in.
You do hear that a lot, don't you?
Yeah, it's strange.
So you're in the Melbourne camp, which I quite like. That's good.
Happy with that answer. Yeah. Sorry, Sydney. And can you cite any early creative influences? Were either of your parents involved in the arts? Or?
Neither of my parents are involved in the arts. My mum's dad was a performer, performed in the war, and, you know, was an entertainer to all the troops and all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
So I think maybe it came from her side. After that, I guess I did go to the Young Talent School, Young Talent Time.
Nice.
Yes. So I guess Danny Minogue's my hero. No. I basically...
Good to get it out.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I did do children's theatre when I was younger, and I started acting when I was about 9. So I guess my influences changed as whatever I was doing changed, really. I'd never really had anyone that I was like, I want to be like so-and-so.
Yeah.
But I did later on like the Young Ones and French and Saunders and all the English sort of sketch comedy
which
stuff.
Which you later went to.
Which
sort of
I went and worked with,
and,
which is amazing. So.
Exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. But I guess what I wanted to cover as well, in an interview on the Neighbours website, would you believe this is where you get all your good information?
Because that's so true.
Yeah. It said that you started your career at the age of 12 on Carson's Law.
Yes.
Which...
Lorraine Bailey.
Lorraine Bailey, that's
get
correct.
Out, really.
It was. And it looks like it was...
You stole my name. Kind
it was a period drama, but it looked like it was Murder, She Wrote, Australian style. Was that basically...
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit... I mean, obviously it was that and The Sullivans, I think, were the two big shows. Danny and Kylie were on The Sullivans. I was on Carson's Law. But we had basically... There wasn't much else drama-wise, I don't think, around that time. Probably later on was Flying Doctors and things like that. But I went into the audition, I think I was younger than 12, actually. I was probably about 9.
Yeah, actually,
nine.
There's the original Perfect Blend article that you did, I don't know how long ago, and then the one you've just done recently, I think, to promote your upcoming show.
Yeah.
And one says that your role was when you were 9 and one said 12, so
yeah. I was on Young Talent Time when I was 12. And I was on Carson's Law when I was 9. But I think when I went into the audition, I'd been doing children's theatre at this theatre that the lady that took the course was from England, and she was very, oh, it's all about drama and theatrical. So we were doing Shakespeare, and I was like 9. So the director said to me, oh, do you know the script? And I said, yeah, and did a few lines. And then he said, what else do you know? No, and I said, I know Portia from The Merchant of Venice. And he's like, what the hell? So he got me to do it. Great. I mean, I had no idea what it was about. Yeah. No idea. Yeah. But, you know, I knew all the words, so that was fun.
Fantastic.
So, Carson's Law when you were 9.
Yeah.
Young Talent Time when you were 12.
Yes, as a contestant.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then did you do any other training through high school or university, or was most of your experience?
Yeah, I went right through primary school into the beginning of high school. I did children's theatre at the same place, and then I left and went to the National Theatre. They had like a youth sort of course, and then after that I went into their adult one. So I stayed at the National for probably 6 years or something.
Yeah. So singing, acting, directing, makeup,
you've got like a lot of
makeup strings. Came later,
I mean, you definitely sound dedicated anyway to the craft.
Yeah.
At what point in your career did you decide that it was necessary to leave Australia and head to the UK?
I didn't really decide it was necessary. I think it was just at the time my sister had met this guy in London. She was going over for him. And we were like, she's like, do you want to come? And I sort of thought, yeah, why not? I didn't really think I was going to go there forever.
That thing where they say, oh, you always go for some guy. You did, went for someone else. Sister's guy.
Yeah. And then I sort of, once I got there, realised there was a lot more opportunity than I'd realised. Like, I didn't know what I was going into. I just thought it would be a working holiday or whatever. But because I'd been working in bands all my life, that was my easy thing to go straight into, was just to do gigs, because I thought then at least I can make money and be working. So the gigs I was doing, the guy that I that we lived with was a guy that I'd gone to high school with, and we had a duo that we used to do through high school, and we used to do all these sort of gigs all around the place. So when I got there, he was doing a lot of the gay clubs, doing his he wasn't doing drag at that stage, just gigs, singing, and he said, come and do some gigs with me. So I did that, and then I had another girl that we'd gone with that we did other gigs on the nights that he couldn't do, she'd do them with me. And then we just got a residency, and we went into this cafe and went, do you have any music? And they said, yeah. We said, can we do it? And they went, well, come and try out and do a night. Right. So we did that, and then we ended up there like 4 or 5 nights a week.
Sorry, was that comedic, or was that?
At that stage, it was just singing pop covers, and then no one was listening, so I changed the words.
And this is the night where you changed the lyrics. And did anyone notice?
Yeah, a few people noticed. And then we'd walk around the tables and sort of make jokes with people, and I'd sit on people's knee and stuff. But it was all people like Dolce & Gabbana, and like I didn't know who anyone was because I'd sort of come home. Like, you know, you'd be sitting there and Jean-Paul Gaultier's there, and you're like, oh, you're nice clothes, mate.
Yeah,
you know?
Nice clothes. You've done well for yourself, haven't you?
And we had a guy that used to come in and request songs, and he'd always sit on his own, and it was Barbara Streisand's son, which I didn't know. Like, I'm just sort of like, you know.
Oh, it's probably good you didn't know. Cause
it was. I think that's why it worked and why they liked it, was because we'd just take the piss and they didn't know, you know. They probably thought we were just pretending to not know who they were, but we really didn't know.
So that was the genesis of Louise from Supergirly?
Yeah, that was how it sort of started. And then an agent came in and said, oh, do you want to do some of the clubs and stuff? And I said to the girl I was working with, I'm going to have to write a show now because we can't go in there and just go, oh, we'll just do a bit of it. We have to do it all or nothing. And she's like, yeah, great. So then we got up the name and, you know,
and went from there.
Made Supergirly, yeah.
Yeah, and why Louise?
Louise? Well, that was my original name. My actual name's Louise. And then when I went, when I came back, I actually was always Lulu all through primary school.
I didn't even think that. Even think what Lulu was short for.
Yeah. I was always Lulu through primary school, and that was always my name. Mm. And then when I went over to the UK, there was a Lulu, obviously Lulu, you know, that sings, shout and everything else. And so anytime I started off saying, oh, it's Lulu from, and they'd go, oh, Lulu. And, no, not that Lulu.
No, a different one.
A different Lulu. So then I thought, I'll be Louise. So once I got home, I was Lulu again. So it's just, it's confusing, but it's.
And so Louise became the character.
Louise became the character. Well, we just used our own names because at that stage, Supergirly was the name of the actual group. Whereas now, being back, Supergirly's the name of my character because I don't,
Yeah,
there you go. I don't use that name anymore.
So. And so you went over there. It must have been freeing too to get over there. And obviously you spoke about it in your paragraph about, you know, being in Australia and then coming to the UK and having this opportunity to let go of all the shackles, I guess,
yeah.
in a way. So must have been nice to be able to do those shows. Was that something you were doing in Australia in any form?
No, I mean, the closest thing I did was, I think when I was like 14 or something, I went on Have a Go, which is a show that Jono and Dano did, and I changed the words to a song on that. But no, before that, I hadn't really done any of the parody stuff. So, yeah.
And hair and makeup, how did that come in?
Well, I'd always done my own
yep.
all through, you know, theatre and stuff. And then when we went to the UK and started doing TV, we got makeup artists to do our hair and makeup and were never happy. And I right. was just like, no, we want it like this. So in the end, I just started doing it.
Yeah.
And then once I came back and I'd work on like a film set or something, the makeup girls would go, what are you doing now? And I'd be like, oh, you know, don't know, nothing. And they'd go, come back and be my assistant. And I'd be like, yeah, okay. So it just sort
so
of came
became the perfect survival
yeah.
job.
Yeah. And then I started doing weddings and all that sort of stuff on the side, which is, you know, something I do now. But yeah, it was a good sideline. I felt like it was still creative, even though it's, you know, not in the same
Well, staying in the industry too.
Yeah.
Did you have any other survival jobs that you could tell us that were a bit of fun while you were over there?
In the UK, when I first got there, I worked at Harrods. Like, did do the, you know, normal job sort of thing. And I, when you go there, you get to watch a video and it tells you, you know, Harrods is a great place to work. Yeah. And this is Mohammed El-Fayed. And when he comes through, he's really friendly and should say hello. So when he came through, everyone looks like they're like shit scared and they're all like staring at him. And I went, hi. And I got fired.
Oh, no, I did not.
I got fired like the next
day.
For
saying hello.
Well, I don't
know. Is that your quickest job ever?
I was there a little while, but no, I think the thing was, it was either that or the other reason it could have been was my manager had come to the restaurant that I worked in the 2 days before, got really drunk and got really into the show, dancing on tables and all that sort of stuff, and then I got fired. So she's either really embarrassed that I'd seen her in her normal form or he was annoyed that I'd said hello. But either way, it's a good story.
Yeah. I feel like it was the latter. I feel like you couldn't have been too nice, could you?
Surely not. They said to say hello.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
So you had 3 sellout seasons on the West End, performed at the Edinburgh Fringe. Then later, I hope I have this chronologically correct.
Fringe was probably the first thing we did because once we met a manager, it sort of goes right back to, there's a guy who does shows called Lenny Beige, who's the character's Lenny Beige, but it's Steve First is the guy that does them. And he does these things called the Regency Rooms where he hosts it and then he gets all these weird acts to come in. So he saw us do a birthday party for Siobhan Faye, who's from Bananarama, and he was there as well that night. And he went, oh, come and do the Regency Rooms. So when we got to the Regency Rooms, there was us and it was Matt Lucas and David Williams and Sacha Baron Cohen and all of these people before they'd, you know, done anything. You know. So they're all doing little sketches and acts and things. And then we just sang a song. And then from then on, we became regulars at the Regency Rooms. But the people that came to the Regency Rooms were like Dave Furnish and, you know, all that sort of lot, which is how I got to meet Elton. And it's sort of a really clicky little place to go.
Yeah.
And the guy that was managing Steve First, I sort of said to him, I want you to manage us, you know, and he's like, nah, I can't see where you'd go, can't see what you'd do.
Yeah.
And then after about a week of us sort of doing different things, he came up and went, yeah, all right, I'm
in. I'm going to manage
you. Changed my
mind. Yeah. And then he sort of said, well, we've got to go and do the Edinburgh Festival. And then from then, once we did that, we were seen by the BBC and everything, and it just sort of exploded.
Right.
And he was one of these managers that's just like, he's like the characteristic of one you'd see in a show. Like he had the big cigar and the glasses. He was sort of like Woody Allen.
Yeah, right.
And he was really just dodgy, really dodgy dealer. Amazing, getting us good stuff, but hard work, you know. Yeah. So it was sort of like, it was all just meant to be. You learn double lessons as you're going along, but that was the beginning of it, just doing Edinburgh.
Mm. Okay, so Edinburgh, then those sellout West End shows?
Yeah, the tours came off the back of Edinburgh.
And then the Just for Laughs Gala in Montreal?
Yeah, well, we did the Just for Laughs. We went over and did like a few gigs and the gala, and then we went back after that. They asked us back to tour on the Just for Laughs tour.
And so it was all developing the Super Girly show. How did you find that in terms of, like, it's great, you know, we put up a new show here and so often it's a one-off.
Yeah,
so if you have the opportunity to develop it at a later stage, it's like, oh, I've done it twice. But to really work on a show, like, that must have been amazing.
Mm.
It is amazing. Like, I think it's just there's so many more places to perform and there's more opportunities. We didn't just do theatre or just do comedy or just do gay clubs. We did all of it, and then we'd be hosting on doing sitcom stuff or sketch comedy, and then we're on kids shows doing sketches, and then we're on doing hosting MTV and VH1 because we were music. Like, everything crossed over all the time. Wow. And there's just a lot of places to be. So if you can fit in all the little niches, you're fine, you know.
Obviously, your content had to change for each medium as well.
Yeah. Right? Well, I was writing articles in, like, they'd give me, you know, makeup products, and then I'd have to do little blurbs on all the makeup, but obviously take the piss out of it as well.
Yeah.
And then be doing kids' magazines, and I was an agony aunt. Can you imagine that? So, but it was like, but in a super girly way. Yeah. But because we were pop, we sort of fitted into the kids, like Smash Hits and all those sort of magazines. And yeah, it was just sort of, it was very bizarre. But I think this all came down to Raz, too, the manager, that was just able to sort of
manage to fit the brand
that
to
we
all
could
the different,
fit into all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Well, we're pretty excited. Nick and I have booked in to see you when you open in a couple of weeks at Tuple Love Tuple. And is it true I had 11 costume changes?
Yeah, well, I actually counted the other day. I think there's 13. Mm. But some of them are like little.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't practiced any of them yet. I think I practiced one and went really well.
It's not like it's not like Soul Mystique where they just throw some
That's
glitter over
you
and then
I
you
want
change.
That.
Yeah.
Just so the other costumes on hangers and just maybe just hold them up.
That's all it is. Yeah, yeah. It's like those paper dolls.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm ready for a duet if we get there and you need some extra hands.
You might need to fill in while I'm changing.
Yeah.
Takes 20 minutes each costume change.
Yeah, great. 20
How
minutes
long is that a show? It's an overnight performance.
Yeah, that's it.
That's right.
Bring your sleeping bag.
And I really want to talk about this because it's quite interesting when we were doing our research on you, the celebrity connection, I'm going to call this, which is, I mean, you've been booked to perform with celebrities like Madonna, Queen, Bananarama, which I want to ask about, Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones. Like, how did it happen? You mentioned the Regency Room. Was it mostly coming from the Regency Room?
Well, the first one came from Boy George coming into the cafe we were singing because it was a gay cafe. Yeah. So it was like we got a lot of... Well, that was why we had Jean-Paul
He
Gautier.
Often drops in when I'm singing down at the local...
Serendipity.
Yeah, that's it. Well, we did this... There was a charity night there one night and they had an auction and one of the prizes was to win the cover of Attitude magazine, which is this big gay magazine over there, and Boy George bid on it. And I think he spent £400 and gave it to us and said, "This is for them. They've got to be on the cover because these guys are going to be huge, you know." But Attitude had an issue with it because we weren't gay. They were like, "Oh, you know, we can't have them on the cover." And he was like, "Well, I paid for it. I want them on the cover."
Yeah.
I think it was a year later that they actually let us on the cover because by then we'd made it. But it was like for ages they wouldn't let us do it.
Isn't that interesting?
But then after that we did another party for David Thomas, who's a stylist now for like Puff Daddy and, you know, I think he's doing Harry Connick Jr. on The Voice and all these different things, or American Idol. He's doing amazing things now, but he had a party at his house and Boy George was there. So that was another, "Oh, hi, remember us?" "Yeah, of course I do. I spent £400 on you."
Yeah.
but we did a few parties that way. And then David, I think, got us Siobhan Faye's 40th birthday, which is from Bananarama.
Yes.
So we met the girls there. And at that party, Jennifer Saunders and her husband, Adrian Edmondson, were there, and Barbara Windsor and... I think there was a few EastEnders and people like that. But I was sitting at a table and Jennifer was sitting next to me and I just performed and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, I so want to talk to her." And it just happened. Mum was over and she was with me and she's going, "Just go over because you're going to regret it if you don't go and say something." So I'm sitting there and this guy taps me on the shoulder and I turn around and it's Adrian and he goes, "Sorry, it's just my wife really wants to meet you and she's too nervous to come over." And I'm like, "Oh my God."
So did you kind of sit next to each
other
quietly?
I don't really want
to
meet her. Yeah, it was just like, "Oh my God." Out of all the people that I've met, like famous people, I think when I met her, it was like, "Oh my God," because I just have loved everything she's done.
And was it a good meeting? Like, you know when you meet your idol and you go, "Oh, I wish I hadn't have done that because it wasn't how I wanted it to play
No, that out. Was all right because we just sort of chatted and she's like, "Oh, you guys just, you know, doing a great job and good luck with everything," sort of thing. And then I met her again at something else. Oh, it was probably the Regency Rooms. She came to that and then she's like, "How's it all going?" And she just, you know, we sort of caught up and then we were at the BBC Christmas party and she came up and she goes, "Oh, I've got some people I want you to meet." And she took me over to introduce me to Stephen Fry and Ben Elton.
Oh.
And she goes, guys, these are the two that are going to be taking over from me and Dawn soon. So I thought you'd want to meet them. And they're like, oh my God. Yeah.
Far out. So it's just connections, connections, connections while you're over there by the sounds of it.
Well, I was saying to someone the other day, I think it's like if you're here, you know, you might meet, I don't know, John Farnham and Glenn Shorrock.
I did actually have a conversation with John in a lift one day. Yeah, about the weather.
Or Molly Meldrum.
I got told to get, you talk about, right?
I have a funny story where I got told to get effed by Jimmy Barnes. So, you know, everyone, that's my connection. Yeah, right.
But not over there, the they're just hanging out. You know, they're always, there's people just out and about. No one seems to bother them or go up and ask for autographs and stuff. It's different to here. But once you meet them, if you're in the little group, then you sort of run into them a bit at different things because everyone seems to go to the same things.
Yeah.
And then from that we then did, after the Regency Rooms and we'd done a few of those things, then we met Dave Furnish who asked us to do Elton's party. That was it. Come to my house, I'm going to have a party. I'm like, who are you? Oh, my boyfriend's Elton John. Oh, okay.
Oh, yes.
Well,
yeah. But the first one was this guy coming into Ballins where we were singing and going, I've got a party this weekend at my house for Madonna. And I was like, yeah, right. It'll just be like some drag queen just as Madonna. Like we had, this was the first one, so we were never thinking it was going to be her.
Yeah.
And when we got there, he was going, oh, just go in the bedroom because I don't want her to see you. You're a surprise. And I'm thinking, surprise. She'll be like, who's that? So she was sitting out on the couch in what looked like a nightie, and there was about 20 people in the lounge. And then he goes, come out, oh, just before you sing, you know, if she doesn't like it, she'll pull the plug on the PA because that's what she did last time. So good luck.
Oh,
you know.
My God.
Yeah.
Oh, you needed to know that.
But that was very surreal to see.
And she didn't pull the plug?
No, she got up and danced and, yeah, she liked it.
So you've had quite a lot of success in the UK.
Mm.
What then triggered the decision to move home?
I got married over there and I got pregnant and then thought I need to come home just to have my family around me, to have my baby and, you know. So my husband and at the time and I moved back, and I think that was a really good decision too, because by the time I got to the point where I was ready to come home, I'd done so much with the same character and been the same character in everything for 8 years that I was just like, no one will put me in anything other than being super girly.
Yeah.
So when I got back and once I'd had Molly, I could then come back and act again in other things as myself or, you know, as different characters. And it was just like, oh, God, you know, this is a nice change.
Yeah.
Because I was sick of it, really.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's really interesting that idea of, you know, how big you were overseas in a way. You know, given your successes over there, it seems almost incredible that your profile here isn't more prominent.
I know, it's like, weird that you have to come back and then
different industries.
Even working, when I first came back, I think my first big job was doing Neighbours. And when I went in, they knew who I was because they know the UK connection and they were like, oh, it's great because we can use that with our UK thing. And so they let me change the script and rewrite some of my lines and make it funny, and they let me sing in it, and they gave me all these bits and pieces that would be, you know, good for them as well.
Well, because we're saying as well, your character on Neighbours was very, very specific. Like, not a lot of characters like
so
that.
Weird.
Do you know what I mean?
I
like, Eva Destruction was the name, and you were a wrestler, weren't you?
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't get many characters like that on Neighbours, so it was very specific, and we thought your exposure from overseas must have helped.
Yeah,
you
well,
score
I think
that.
When I went in, they didn't really know, but I went in and thought, I don't like this part of the script, so I'm going to change it in the audition because I was so used to just doing what I wanted.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that now. I don't know why.
It's quite funny. You know, we'd go do that, Lauren, and they go, get out.
Yeah, that's it. Can you please keep to the script?
Yeah. Correct.
But I went and did that, and they were sort of like, oh, that was different. I went, yeah, sorry, I just thought I'd make it a bit funny. And they're like, yeah, that was funny. So then after that, they were like, yeah, we'll just do a bit more of that stuff.
Right.
So comedy is clearly a very strong element of your work. And you mentioned in your story that you're always singing and acting. At what point, you know, is the comic element something that came into your work later on, or have you always been entertaining people, trying to make them laugh?
I was talking about this the other day because when I did children's theatre, we used to go around old people's homes and do, like, you know, old-time musical sort of acts and stuff. And my drama teacher, she used to send me to auditions and stuff, and she'd ring them and go, she's coming in, oh, she's so funny. Wait till you see her, she's hilarious. And then I'd get there and it'd be like an orange juice commercial and there's one line and you're not meant to be funny, you know. No. And I'm like just saying it and they're like, she wasn't that funny.
No, yeah.
I'm like, well, she
wasn't. That's one line, you know.
But I think it was that
thing. I mean, she has good diction.
Yeah.
For what that's worth.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. But Yeah, I think I was always the funny one at drama school. But it was only just the other day, actually, I got an audition for Wentworth and I was doing, like, it was for one of the new...
As a wrestler?
No. May as well have been. Another lesbian part, which I've now played three. I'm starting to think I'm typecast in that as well. But, yeah, I was actually relieved because I'm like, oh, good, people can realise that I can do drama as well, you know, starting to cross over.
Oh, well, that's the beautiful thing about comedy, isn't it, that, you know, the best comedians can play really good drama because of the tragedy.
I think it's that thing too, though, of you just have to watch yourself because you do always look for the funny in things. Like, and Wentworth could be hilarious. If you let it.
If you let it, yeah.
But yeah, no, it's hard to sort of go in and
so
go.
Is it about reining yourself in or do you feel it's a different part of your brain that you need to?
I think you just, you have to sort of rein yourself in a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of comedy, which we were...
Luckily.
Yeah, do you like that connection? You mentioned on your website that your role on Bogan Pride, Aunt Cassandra, was your favourite.
Yeah.
Your most memorable. Why was that?
I think when I went for the audition, I actually got the scene and I thought the scene was funny and went in for the audition. I really thought it was one scene. I didn't know it was anything bigger than that. So when I got the part, I was like, oh my God, it's a main role. No idea. And I hadn't worked with Rebel before. Yeah. But just the cast, I mean, everyone was really amazing to work with.
Yeah.
The director's so gorgeous. I love him. And he's one of these actors, directors that he's acted. So he knows, you know, how to communicate. And
great.
And I think they just gave me a little bit of free rein on that too. Like Rebel, I'd always go to her and I'd do stuff and the producer would go, no, no, we don't want it, blah, blah, blah. And I'd think, really? And then I'd go to Rebel and go, did you want this? And she'd go, yeah.
Oh, nice.
So it was a bit because she wrote it, it was having the writer there and going, "Is it? I thought that's what you want." And she's like, yeah, that is what I want. It was all that repetitive, you know, like Jesus and all that. And I'd go, he'd go, don't say it the same every time. And I'd think, I thought it was one of those catchphrases.
Yeah.
And she'd go, yeah, we want a catchphrase, you know.
It's interesting. I did a class with Rebel years ago. I was telling Nick this when we were doing research for the interview. And we did a class on comedy. And, of course, at the end everyone got to read a script and see how hilarious they were. And everything that Rebel did was just really naturally comedic. And I guess for me that was a really good example of, you know, I think I can occasionally be a bit funny. I hope. But yeah, just really seeing comedy be used as a tool. Like, it must have been great working with her. Your flair for comic timing strikes me as being quite similar to hers.
I think the thing with Rebel was I appreciated the fact that she didn't try and get people in it that weren't as funny as her or that weren't going to be as, you know, bring anything to it. Like, some comedians are really threatened by other funny people and they don't want anyone as funny as them in it. She wanted people that were funny or funnier. So she was like, I just want you to do whatever you want to do and I've hired you because I think you're funny. So that, for me, shows, one, how secure she is, and two, that she just wanted a bloody good show, which is, it was her first thing that she'd written and she produced and she was in. So she was out of her depth a little bit in that too. And I think once we had conversations about what I'd done in the UK and all the stuff I'd produced and stuff, she's like, okay, so you now know where I'm coming from. Yeah. She goes, I don't know how friendly to be with everyone because I feel like I've got to have this producer role thing as well, only because you've got to have that status thing just so you can make decisions.
If you don't give yourself the status.
And it wasn't her being, you know, big-headed or anything. And I'm like, no, that's fine. You can still have that and still be friendly with people as long as people know that if it comes down to it, you're making decisions.
You're making decisions,
And that's, people should respect that anyway. And everyone did because everyone's like, you know, it's amazing you've even written a show and got it up.
Yeah, well, that's right. Supportive. And it's funny you mentioned about sometimes stand-up comedians do face that problem because it's such a individual sport, if you will. So once you get into a cast like that, there's not as much give and take, which is probably very important in a
I
show like that.
I think women in comedy in general find it difficult too because when you're in, well, you know, it's a very male-based, you know, thing to be doing comedy, and it's always women aren't as funny as men and all that sort of rubbish, so it's nice to have a show that was mainly female based. I think we didn't have, and it wasn't in a way that we were making men look any worse, it was just that it was, there was funny women in it, so it was,
and something completely new on Aussie TV, which is
and she
needed.
Took it wrong to the wrong area all the time, which I love, you know, and people that push those boundaries I just think good, you know, that's what I always love.
So let's talk about this starting from scratch. You've obviously been working hard since you came home to Australia. You've appeared in a number of feature films over the last few years, performing with Ryan Quanten in Not Suitable for Children. Your role on Neighbours, Six Plots, The Sunset Six. You've also created and starred in your own TV soap opera, The Happiness, The Heartache. As a storyteller, sorry, where am I going with this?
I'm waiting.
Okay, I've set it up. Are you ready?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're obviously working in a number of different mediums and, you know, really giving it everything you've got. Is there a medium that you prefer as a storyteller, or do you just feel like if you were performing and storytelling stories that that's enough?
I think I like to appreciate a good script. I'm a writer, so I always come from how good are the words. And you're not actually going to ever do a show that you aren't going to enjoy unless you find it a good piece of writing. And I think you're only as good as your writer as well. Like, I mean, you can't really go into something and go, oh, I was amazing in that film. Mm. It's like, if the script wasn't good in the first place, you know, you're not going to be amazing unless they go, you can improvise the whole thing. I did Not Suitable for Children because Peter Templeman, who directed Bogan Pride, directed that. And he rang me and said, I've got a part for you, we've come up with for you. And Michael Lucas has written it, and I know Michael's an amazing writer. And he said, it's not very attractive. And I went, they never are, Pete. You know, like after Bogan Pride, you know, what can I say? But to me, it's like anything that they, when someone thinks of you for a role or, you know, thinks that you're suitable for it, you've got to have a look at it. And I just, even that one little scene, it was such a funny little scene.
Oh, beautiful scene.
And it
really
was
good.
And I, when I went to the preview.
I have to admit, I wanted to see more of you though. I'm like,
I did too.
No, give her another scene.
Well, that's also good, you know. Yeah. If you come out and people want to see more, that's better than not wanting to see you at all.
Yeah.
But at the premiere, they had like, you know, this big premiere in Sydney. And when I came on stage, the whole audience went, oh, and I thought, that's exactly what I want, like just that. And no one knew who I was because I was talking to people afterwards and they're like, oh, are you in it? And I'm like, yeah, I'm the one they groaned at. And they're like, oh my God, you know, which I love because when I went into wardrobe and that, they were like, what do you want to do with your hair and makeup? I went, am I wearing makeup? I don't think so.
No,
you know, okay, cool. You know, I love that.
It was quite funny after having seen you in all your shots for Super Girly. It was like the exact opposite.
So
But they're my sort of favourite things, I think. Yeah. And also just anything, like, I mean, at the moment I'm writing features that I want to sell, and Happiness I wrote in 1998 or something. So they're all shows that I've sort of developed and want to do. But I think if you can get your own stuff off the ground, obviously it comes from that place of something you really want to do.
Yeah.
And so that's been in your back pocket for quite some years.
Yeah. I think it first came about at high school. I had to do some sort of project for, you know, year 11 or something, and we had to write something, and I wrote that. So I got all the students in it. It's changed since then, obviously.
Yeah.
But
And what made you pick it up again?
It was actually Anna, who's in it, and she doesn't do any acting anymore, and she's like, I really want to do something again. Whatever happened to that? And I was like, yeah, what did happen to that? So I wrote the second episode, and then we started sort of promoting it. We were going to do a series of it and do a possible campaign and everything. And as soon as I put it out on the internet, all the people from The Bold and Beautiful started contacting me and going, oh, my God, I love it. If you need anyone in it, you know. So I had Taylor and Thorne, and they're all – because they're all like – there's an episode now, I think Thorne was in the basement, and, you know, we don't even see him anymore. I'm like, where's Thorne? You know, he still looks all right. Why is he in the basement? He's like, yeah, wow. I'll come and do your show when it's finished. So, and the woman that does all the drama coaching and everything said, I'll come and coach for the show. And I was like, you realise we have no money and we're in Australia. Yeah. She's like, no, I didn't know that. But when you've got money. No, but it was just nice to hear that they thought it was a great idea, and because they could have either done that or they could have gone, why are you taking us off for?
Yeah.
So now we're going to do it as a web series first,
and
then at least we can show it.
Use that
before
as a platform.
We sell it. Yeah.
See, there's a real theme coming through of connections here as well, isn't it? You've built yourself a great, almost base of people that seem to be coming back into your lives. And it's really nice to hear as well that old scripts that you might have written many, many years ago can come back into your life.
Makes me want to go home and have a
look.
Look through our old scripts and go, what can we revive here, Lauren?
Well, even the other night
this could end badly for everyone.
I went and saw Michael Bublé and he was singing some song and he said, I wrote this when I was 16. And he played the beginning of it and it was some ballad. And then he said, On This Is What It Is Now. And it's his latest hit.
Fantastic.
He just changed it, you know, and he just goes to show, you know, if you've got something that's got a bit of a starter, you know, as long as you're happy to rewrite.
Yeah. And so themes as well when you write, is there ones that come up all the time for you? I feel like there's a couple of issues that probably come up throughout. Are there any that you particularly feel like?
I don't know. I've got a writing partner that I met probably about 6 years ago and we write a lot of stuff together. We're not very similar people, but what we did was we sort of got together and went, I've got this idea. I love thrillers and I love like horrors and stuff. And I would watch them more than I'd watch comedies because I suppose because I've got so much comedy in my life.
Yeah.
And she's sort of the same. So, but we always end up writing comedy horrors.
Meshing of the two worlds.
Yeah. So it's sort of good. But what we did at first was map out the idea for a script. And then we go, okay, you write the first half, I'll write the second half. You start at page 20 and I'll start at one. And we put them together and went, oh, my God, they match. And then we'd swap and then we'd rewrite each other's.
Wow.
And I think when you find that, you're just sort of like...
Find that voice that's similar.
Yeah. And I'd go to her and go, I've got this idea for a script and blah, blah, blah. And then she'd go, what about if it goes... Bleh? And it just ends up being totally somewhere else. And then, she brings stuff in. It's just having that other person to sound off and, take things in a different direction. But I think mainly now my reoccurring thing is I keep going back to the thriller sort of horror thing.
Yeah. And so these are the feature films that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, we've got two at the moment that we're going to try and sell, flog.
Flog.
one's a comedy thriller, which we actually won an award for the script idea about 4 or 5 years ago through Screen Australia. And
yeah, so you know it's a strong idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we've written the script for that, so that's sort of on its feet to go. And the other one's a musical, which... I've wanted to do for a long time, so, and it's comedy.
Yeah.
It's a bit wrong.
And so you've done, obviously you worked in the UK, one of the feature films you worked on, Aquamarine, that was an American one.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
How do you feel about doing more work in the American industry?
God, that's what you love, isn't it? I mean, anyone that can get into I actually went over to the States and tried to pitch Supergirly as a... I had a sitcom idea and my agent at the time was like, oh, no, you need to get in and do reality TV. So she changed the idea and we went in and pitched it as Supergirly hosting a show.
Yes.
And I said to her, well, I'm not pitching anything unless I'm in character because they're not going to get it. And she goes, oh, you can't go in character here. They're very serious about their pitches and they want it very, it's got to be, business. And I went, well, I can't do it unless it's in character because they won't get it.
Mm.
So I'd go in these full-on outfits and I went in... I went into the E! Entertainment and I'm sitting in the foyer and there's all these girls grazing, looking at me and sort of talking about me and going, oh, my God, look at them. And I could hear them and then the girl comes out and she goes, oh, you look amazing. And I went, oh, thanks. They didn't think so. And pointed at them. Good. She goes, oh, they're from the Style Network. So it was sort of like I just felt like I could do whatever I wanted. And I'd do the pitch and at the end of it I'd go, so do you want to buy it? And their face was just like, whoa.
Yeah.
But they loved the character and everything. Fantastic. They just said, you've got to build your profile at home and then come back. So they have
great feedback to have.
Yeah. So now I feel like the actual musical I want to do, I think, is my little vehicle. It's not super girly, but it's got that sort of comedy rom-com, feel to it. And if we can get that made, that's my little project. And I'd love to do that as a co-production with the UK or...
I do want to ask about your costumes, which are, they're amazing. Who are you wearing?
Who am I wearing? I'm mainly wearing Spotlight and Lincraft.
Yes.
My God.
Sometimes Adairs when the Christmas sales are on. I basically just get basic corsets and skirts and I just decorate them with stuff that I find that I like. On this Supergirly show that we've got coming up, I've got a costume maker who's come in because I went in and sort of went, I can't do this top because it's too hard to get into and out of. And she's like, put a zip in it. And I'm like, you can put a zip in something? So she's amazing. She's just volunteered. She's a student that was doing costume and design and stuff. And she's our intern. I'm like, I love you so much. So she's come up with some sort of ways of doing stuff. But most of it's, it's just bits and pieces I find that I just sew onto them.
And it must be an amazing opportunity from her perspective to create these really larger than life, beautiful, beautiful costumes. Like, I can't think of other shows where you would necessarily get to do that.
No, well, the costume designer we had in the UK was amazing. He was like this guy that did like big sort of rock videos and all that sort of stuff. And I'd go in and he'd go, I was thinking maybe a sailor and a you know, a sailor and a marching girl. And I'm like, really? Sounds really shit, you know. And then he'd come out with these sequin sailor and this marching girl with like spikes all over. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool.
Well, that's the thing too, because I mean, I just looking around right now, I get a good understanding about what you could possibly do with your outfits, couldn't you? Like, it's very much a niche look, isn't it? And so you've got a bit of freedom to go
nuts. I think it sort of comes from that drag queen side as well. Yeah. Like, I mean, working in drag with drag queens for a long time, you'd look at things and go, how'd you do that? And they're just like, oh, it's a bit of this, and I just put a bit of that on the top, and you're like, wow. You know?
And there it is.
And half the time it's like, actually, the girl that's making our costumes, Jessie, she's a drag king, so she makes a lot of stuff for herself to do.
Great.
So half the time she's like, why don't you just do this, this, and this? And I'm like, oh, my God,
great
good
idea. Excellent. And super girly Return of the Pop Princess is being brought to us by Adam Fawcett and Lyle Brooks, who are part of Lab Kelpie. And I was looking at their ethos the other day, and on their website it says, from the start it has been theatre's business to entertain people. It needs no other passport other than fun, which I think would have fit right into exactly what you do. So how's your relationship with those guys? It's obviously quite strong.
Oh, well, I met them doing Fat Pig. Actually, the beginning of meeting Lyle was because we both went to the opening night of, I think it was Hold the Pickle at the Arts Centre, and this publicist put us together in a photo, and I'm like standing there going, hello, and getting my photo taken with him, and everyone's sort of saying to me later on, who was that guy? And I'm like, oh, I've got no idea, but what a spunk.
And you said that was Bradley.
Bradley Cooper. And then he rang me about a year later and went, hi, don't know if you remember, we got our photo taken together. I'm like, hell yeah, I remember you.
Yeah.
So then it became, just come and meet us. We want to talk to you about doing Fat Pig. And they were really worried about asking me to do it because it's a play, basically.
It's not
the nicest part. But for me, it was like, it's that thing too of going back into theatre, a perfect, you know,
vehicle.
And it's a perfect show because it is so confronting and so full on. But it is fun and it's lighthearted for me. And the director was Daniel Fredrickson, who I'd always wanted to work with. So, and Patrick, I got involved later on, Patrick Harvey, because they wanted someone quirky and fun. And I was like, I work with him on Neighbours. He's amazing.
Yeah.
And Cassie was great. So we all just got along really well. And then when the show finished, I was like, I don't really want to finish this. I don't ever want to not work with you again.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I really want to do Supergirly again, but I didn't know if they'd want to do it. So I mentioned it to Adam and he's like, we'd love to. And then all of a sudden I was like, ringing Lyle going, how do you feel about singing a few songs? I just found out he'd done cruise ships and stuff, and I was like, I didn't know he sang.
Oh, he's a great singer,
So all of a sudden I was like, I'm excited.
And so that must bring a whole other element to it as well, because you're used to working on it.
Yeah, well, I was on my own for a while. And then also he sort of sent me a message and goes, feel free to say no, but I'm wondering if you want a co-director. And I went, you know what? Yeah, because I haven't had fresh eyes on it for a long time. I'm so set in what I do. So that's been challenging but great, you know. Yeah. And to have both of us directing, and it's a little bit like, I don't know, no. And even when we went through the songs, we have this running joke now, because one of the songs I sang when we were working out which ones to do, and Lyle goes, that's not very Lab Kelpie. And I...
Can I
goes, what does that mean? You know, then we're laughing about it. So anything that comes up now, I don't think that's very lovely.
Well, it's funny you say that too, because I was about to bring this up, actually. I've got Lyle on my Facebook, haven't got you, Lulu, but every day, I reckon, in my Facebook posts, I get images like this, and this one's a picture of a dog with fairy lights around
that
it.
That was our lighting technician.
Yes, correct. And it said, I think I've got an idea for our lighting, was basically what was attached to that. So obviously you get along, and
that came about because we went to pitch Fat Pig at Long Paddock and do it for the tour, and we're sitting in, everyone's doing their pitches up on the stage, and every now and then I'd just get my phone and show Lyle and go, but look at a puppy. And And he'd go, oh, my God. Like, so when we got back, he'd send me a puppy. This is today's puppy. And then I've just taken it and run with it. I'm like, you like puppies? The whole show, basically, we had Louis, who's like a little Jack Russell. Oh, no, he's a Pomeranian cross Chihuahua. And that was the director's dog on Fat Pig. So he came to set every day.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, my God, it's a puppy. He was about like 10 weeks or something. Yeah. Adam and Lyle have two dogs. I have three. Mm. And Patrick's got one. So at the end, we were like, let's all just meet in a puppy park for our party and have puppies.
Yeah. No sex, drugs and rock and roll. We'll meet in a puppy park and that's a wrap party.
So we've sort of all got along on the basis that we love dogs.
Yeah, fantastic. I was thinking, who is this Lulu girl posting all these dog photos
at
every day?
At first we just kept doing them and forgetting that everyone else could see what we're posting. Now it's like, oh, whatever. Delete us if you want. Take care. If you don't like puppies, we don't like you.
Oh, very good.
Okay, let's drop it down a note. I want to ask about, in your story, you talk about the idea of luck versus hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And through everything that's come up, through everything we've talked about so far, it seems like you do have a lot of connections, but you've always made the most of opportunities, taken the initiative, that you are a real hard worker. Can you talk more about that?
I think luck plays a big part, to be honest. I think you have to be in the right place at the right time, which I've really put London down to. I think I was in the right place at the right time. I found a niche in the market and I ran with it. Like, I don't think it's all about I just came up with the show that everyone wanted at the time. But I think it's then a matter of making the most or realising the luck when you see it as well and taking it. Like, Elton had said to me a couple of times, if I can ever do anything to help you or whatever, just let me know. So when he had his tour in Australia coming up, I didn't know it was happening because we're in London, they don't advertise it there. Mum sent me a message and said, Elton's touring Australia and I don't know who his support act is. And I went, cool, I'll ask him.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I just said, well, can I ask? He can say no. Yeah. And he said, oh, I have to have an Australian support act. So that's perfect for me. Yeah, okay.
Wow.
But the thing is, I wasn't going to get offended if he said no either, because I thought, he probably will. You know, I didn't really expect him to say yes. But
Well, that kind of raises the next question for me. Mm. I've always try to do reading.
You want to be my support?
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to wait till after we finished recording.
And
but,
audition now.
Now's
give
a
us
great
a number?
Time to ask.
Yeah.
I've been doing a lot of reading, I guess, always reading and listening to things and trying to stay motivated and, continue to expand your creative brain, all of that sort of stuff. And one of the things that has stuck with me recently is whatever you're afraid of, wherever you discover fear when you think about something, that's probably the direction you should be going.
Well, that's why I did Fat Pig, because that was one of those ones that I never do shows where it's sort of talking about weight or how you look or anything like that. So when they brought it up, I was sort of like, oh, yeah, whatever. I'm at the stage of my life where it's like, fine, And out of – it was only in the rehearsals that I got in there and thought, oh, shit, now I've hit what I didn't want to do. Mm. Because Lyle and Daniel were talking about when he walks in and I'm sitting at the table and Daniel's going, it's an automatic love connection and you see her. And Lyle's going, I wouldn't be in love with that though. There's no way I'd just walk in and be in love with it. And he's pointing at me and I'm sitting there thinking, I'm okay. And I just felt all of a sudden like, oh God, this is like hideous, And then you've got to just go, okay, I know he's not talking about me, but they're still talking about you because it is you, And I said something to Lyle and he goes, don't even go there because it took me 3 months to ask you to do the show. And he was sort of like so aware of the fact. And I thought, that's the thing too, is it's everyone else's perception. And I know Paddy came up to me after the first rehearsal and went, you all right? It's really full on. Everyone's saying these horrible things about you. And it was because when I'd read the script, obviously you read the whole thing.
Yeah.
But when you do when I'm doing my scenes, all my scenes with Lyle were lovely. And the characters are having this lovely time. It's all the other shit's
other
happening
stuff.
On stage that's when I'm not there. But in rehearsal, you're hearing them saying it all, So it's really full on. And I think that show really made me realise I needed to do that to get out of that habit of – because even in Supergirly, I don't mention weight, I don't talk about – I'm always saying how, me and Paris Hilton look the same.
Yeah.
So it's never been something that I always go for the opposite because I think the whole fat joke thing's just
been done and not necessarily
funny. And even though in Fat Pig it's not really – It's really the other characters that have the issue. My character didn't have an issue with it. So she was similar to me in that way. But the way she reacts to things and self-deprecating and all that, I'm not like that at all, because I would just never go, does my bum look big in this? Why would you ask?
Yeah.
So it was really good to do it. And now I spoke to Katrina Milosevic. She was saying she did the Sydney Theatre Company version. Mm-hmm. And she had a really hard time with it. She said, you know, it was probably the worst thing she ever did. She came out afterwards almost needing therapy because she was so destroyed by it. And I thought, I never let that get in my head. I never let it be, this is about me, because it wasn't.
Yeah.
But I can see how she got there. And I think her version of it, they didn't do the up, happy, fun, funny side, which I took it the opposite way. And I think the show could be really down if you did it that way.
But I think if you play too much of the drama in Neil LaBute, that's what happens, and it's meant to be a balance.
Yeah, that's right. So I didn't see the Sydney Theatre Company version, but a lot of people said, oh, they came out just wanting to, you know, top themselves, because it was so harrowing. But
it's interesting you're talking about mindset and how you look at the character too, because a lot of the stuff we've been talking about in the earlier part of this podcast is about mindset and how you look at things.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting to
and what
hear.
You let affect you and
you know, what road you take.
That's it. And I think I was reading something about Sally Field one day, and she was saying, because someone said to her, how do you get into, it was that scene in Steel Magnolias where she's crying, and someone said, oh, well, you know, what were you thinking about? And she's like, well, I was thinking about my daughter was dying of cancer, and, you know, I'm just in the moment. And I thought, that's all it is. It's just a matter of you're in it when you do it. But because someone said to me, oh, it's so hard watching Fat Pig, and I'm hoping not to ruin anyone's, you know, idea of if they haven't seen it. But the final scene is so sad and so full on, and, you know, basically getting dumped every night for 2 weeks or whatever. And you'd come out sort of feeling a bit like, you do feel a little bit like, oh, God, I can't do that again, you know. But then you're laughing in the foyer with the guys, and, you know, people are having a go at Lyle because he's such a prick. And I'm like, it's not really him, you know. You know, it's hard to sort of, for even people watching it, to go, it's not you or whatever.
Correct.
People would come up to me afterwards and go, oh, you know, come on, you're very pretty. And I'd think, you know, like, it's not.
Yeah,
you know, but then again, you think, well, we've done our job. People will believe what we've done. But, yeah, it's quite full on.
And what motivates you just generally in the industry? What keeps you driving? Because, as I said, coming back from the UK to Australia, having to start from scratch, we've talked about it, to then go, God, I've got to get myself up and do this again. What drives you? What gets you up in the morning?
I think it's just, I don't ever want to do anything else. I've always just wanted to perform. And I'm not one of these people with that I go, oh, how much am I going to make from that? Like, if something's a good project, not to say that I want to do stuff for free, but but if it's a good project and it's something I believe in, then I'll do it. I've been doing these short films for a friend of mine, Mia Kate Russell, who does a lot of amazing short films. She's just a new director, but she's so great at it. And her team is amazing. She always has really good, you know, actors in it. And she tries to look after you, because she's come from that crew side of going, you know, none of us want to do, you know, harrowing days for no rewards. But she puts it in all the festivals and stuff. And I just think it's just that thing of working with great people. And then you get to know another crew that, you know, well, we ended up doing Pickett's Charge because of that, because Mia knew Anna. And, you know, you just sort of go from one thing to the other. And those sort of things, I don't know, they all come round, you know. When I was working out to do Happiness, I'm thinking, well, I'd love Anna to do, you know, the set stuff, Mia can do makeup. Like, everyone helps each other out, and you get your little crew. And I never had that in the UK, really, because I didn't come from a crew side. I wasn't doing makeup and stuff over there. So coming back and working on the crew, you start to appreciate them as a whole different being. Yes.
It's also that thing of being in a larger industry, that you can be more specific about the work you're doing. And one of the great things about working in a minor industry is that you get to experience a whole heap of different roles, because you need to do that to get your work up. And I think in that way it gives you more opportunity.
I think the thing is, as soon as I get up, and if there's nothing happening, I've always got something to do. I'm always either writing something or preparing something else. Well, even when we finished Fat Pig, Lyle and I put together a duo. We've got a trio with me and Patty and Lyle that we do. I'm just about to start another Morning Melodies thing with this other guy, just to have other stuff to do in between, and you know, keep performing and working with people I like. I like to gather these little sort of posses of actors that I go, what else can we do together?
Horde actors, basically. Yeah.
Well, with the feature, you know, the first feature we got, the thriller, I've already cast Daniel Fredrickson and Lyle and Perry Cummings, who I work with.
Oh, like, Perry's great.
Yeah, so we just sort of go, okay, who else do we want in it, you know? Yeah.
Well, Nick and I will have a look at our diaries.
Let us know. I'm already doing a duet, so I don't want to overdo my diary here. But it is something that comes up quite a lot in all of these podcasts, this idea of create.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, you've just got to do it. And I keep mentioning Adam Cass's statement of like, you'll do 400 shows and look, if you're lucky, two or three of them will be successful.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But it's about creating and creating, and you get better as you go, you know? And you start creating, and as long as you're doing what you love, it's not work, is it, really, at the end of the day?
And I think it's that thing of just thinking. It's a positive thinking thing all the time, isn't it? And going, this show is going to be successful and we are going to do it again. And like you're saying, you know, you do shows sometimes and they don't ever do anything else. And I just think, well, they do if you want them to. Yeah. Like with
exactly.
Fat Pig, I was like, why aren't we touring? What are we doing?
And
Lyle's like, oh, okay, I'll fill in the stuff.
And now
we're going on tour. Like,
yes.
You know, it's just sometimes it's a matter of going, like they're first-time producers, but God, they're great. Like Chapel Off Chapel said to them, you're the best producers we've had.
Fantastic.
And I'm talking about all of the producers, which is amazing for a first-time producer.
Yeah, yeah.
But they've just got a real, they know how to work.
But they've also
with
been working for a while and, you know,
Yeah. But it's just that attitude of being good to work with. You want to be someone that people want to come back and work with again. And I think that's the key, really.
Mm. Well, all of this has been wonderful.
That's because you've written that down.
Yeah. No, I actually haven't.
All of this has been
that was fair. That was off the cuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. See, that's me improving right there. This bit is written down.
All right.
You have so much talent and experience and determination. Let's say for a second that you were a mentor to Nick and I.
Okay.
God knows I need one.
I knew Lulu first.
Yeah. Okay, she's yours.
What advice would you give to us for our own careers?
If you were starting as actors or performers or what?
No, I reckon more from, you know, we've been in the acting industry for a little while.
Yeah.
What would your advice be, you know, coming from your background, you're sitting down, if you were had a class with actors, what would you say to them as one golden piece of advice?
I think my main advice would be to be easy to work with, be thankful to have work. So every time you do a job, you're happy to be there and you're thankful for it. Be nice to the receptionist.
That's a good point. Yes.
Because every audition you go into, they do talk to the other people. And your audition is your work. So never think of an audition as a horrible thing to do. Your audition is basic. You're a professional auditioner. That's what you do. So that should be the most fun thing you do all week. So go in and just love an audition. And that comes across. And then people realise that you're fun to work with. Half the time, the audition isn't what you do work-wise or word-wise. It's how they feel like they can relate to you and all that sort of thing. And I think create. Try and think of other things you can do. If you're not a writer but you have really vivid dreams, write them down because they're sometimes really good ideas. And find a writer. Find someone that writes and just go, I've got this idea that I can't write, but would you want to work with me? If you meet people that you like, catch up with them again. Just keep connections. And it's not about networking and being like a brown noser. It's just a matter of finding people you like and collecting your little posse and going, well, you're a cameraman. I got along well with you. Do you want to come and film something on the weekend? Like, even if we're just mucking around, because, you know, webcasts and podcasts and everything else, you know, it's all out there on the internet now, and that's the way to get seen and get other stuff going. I think it's all coming from just being accessible and doing stuff while you're not working, and just keep learning all the time. Yeah.
Well, that was about, I don't know, kind of 12
20
piece
lessons.
Of advice.
Sorry.
No, that's right.
That's too much.
No, it was great. It was a pleasure to talk to you today, Lulu.
You
so
too. Thank you.
We'll see you later on at Chapel Off Chapel for your show. Circle of Life, Lion King. If you want to sing a song with me, that's my thing.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, we might say.
Good, you've got it down. You already know it. That's great.
That's all I know.
So thanks for chatting again, and we'll see you then.
Cool.
Thanks, Lulu.
Bye.
What were your takeouts?
Oh, it was also exciting. Well, I think I agreed with everything she said right at the end there.
All 20 points, yes.
All 20 points.
Fantastic.
I agreed with most of the things she said.
Yeah.
I mean, such an impressive career and continuing to work in so many fields. And what am I saying? I think the thing for me that I really got from that is this idea of realizing opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, if part of our career relies on luck, well, you know, there's not much we can do about that. We can control the hard work, but then if you get so caught up in being in control of everything, then that's its own kind of stress. But you put yourself out there, you work hard, you continue to learn, and then when luck comes along, you're in a really great position to make the most of it.
That's right. And we spoke about this during the week off air, Lauren, about this idea of prepping for luck, like almost making your own luck in a lot of cases. Like even Lulu was talking about it where she said it was lucky, but she also had the guts to then go and email Sorelt and John and say, hey, there's an opportunity.
We should see if she's got his number.
Yeah, that's great. I'll email him, tell him about Lion King. Well, he was a part of it, so there you go. But that, yeah, so I take that idea of, yes, luck is a part of it, but it's also the preparation for luck.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
That's right. I'm just helping you out there.
Making that clear to me. What did you take? What did you take out of the interview?
We've been talking a lot about mindset recently, and I took out this idea of your job is to be a professional auditioner. And I really love that because it's about the mindset you take into auditions as well, and making sure that you, it's not a bad experience. It's supposed to be a really good experience, and it's your opportunity to show you and your art. So rather than making it an experience where it could be nerve-wracking, going, oh, I didn't do this right, I didn't do that right, going in and enjoying the process and putting yourself out there and showing what you can do as an artist. So that idea of being a professional auditioner came across for me.
I agree wholeheartedly. I had no idea until we started researching her exactly how much work she's done.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing Super Girly in a couple of weeks.
Oh, tell me about it. Pink, my new favourite colour. Watch out. So what's up for this month, Lauren? What are your plans?
Well, one of the things on my radar for this month, I'm finishing up my full-time work that I do during the day. And so going forward, I'm going to be a full-time actor. And I'm really looking forward to having all of my time and energy to dedicate to my life as an artist.
Full-time artist. I can see the beams coming out of your face, how happy you are right now. So that's a big leap to take.
Yes, but it's really exciting to be talking to Lulu just before I do that because obviously she's been doing just that. She's created great work, but she continues to work and stay motivated. Very exciting stuff.
Yeah. I'm sure you will fill your 5 days a week, no problem. 7 days even with acting things.
I'm sure the time will get filled up. And, you know, I keep thinking about how things happen at the right time.
Yeah.
A year or so ago, I would have been really excited
to
make this change. Yeah. At any point, it's an exciting step to take. But the fact that it's happened now, I just feel really ready. You know, I've got the ongoing voice classes. I'm doing the gratitude stuff with Andrea. We've got this podcast. I just feel like I'm in a really good place for the next chapter.
Look, having done a scaled down version of what you're doing, it's very empowering to be able to take those extra days for yourself and really concentrate your energies into acting. So good on you.
Well, what about you, Nick?
Well, I think as we've already touched on, my month really is going to be still about gaining control of my mindset and really developing that. I mean, I love this podcast. I've talked about it 100 times, but this is part
only
of
100?
It.
What?
Yeah, only 100, that's right. But, you know, being able to talk through things and helping other people and talking to other people is what it's about, really. And we talked about community. So, look, I'm excited to continue that thought process and that mindset.
Yeah.
But I did want to try something different this month as well, and I'd love to turn it back onto our audience. Basically, I'm looking for a book to read. I'm looking for something that will help me with my mindset, something that I can read and come back and maybe even give a review next month, Lauren.
Nice.
But something that will help me. So I'm putting it out to the community. If you have a book, anything, give me something that will motivate me and inspire me.
Pretty strange books.
Correct. Yeah. Penthouse is not a book that will inspire.
Have you ever seen that book on how to knit with cat hair?
Oh.
Yeah, I'll look it up for you.
Weirdly, that sounds great.
Well, it's not a book, but I would like to recommend something to you, Nick.
Yes. Oh, please do. Yes.
I don't know if you subscribe to the Nosebleed Chronicles.
Not at the moment.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But this is a weekly performing arts e-newsletter that includes information on artistic events and training and things that are happening in the arts sector across Australia.
Across Australia? Yeah, great.
Yeah, and there's often little inspirational links in there. I mean, the title gives you a bit of a clue to the tone.
Yeah.
Some of it's a bit fun, but it's just a really great resource. You subscribe, it comes to inbox weekly.
Oh, nice.
And it's a great resource for actors. So
yeah, great. Well, thank you for starting the inspiration.
No worries. And I'll pop the details up on our site for anyone else who's interested. I definitely recommend it.
And of course, we mentioned the Actors Process online TV show briefly at the top of the podcast. The show officially launches on the 11th of May, but the trailer is now online, so you can go and check it out. It's the
Actors. It looks pretty schmick.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And yeah. The actorsprocess.tv, we'll put all the links on the website. Claire, who hosts it, is an actor and teacher in the industry and has pulled together a stellar cast. I'm talking industry heavyweights here, from teachers to directors, producers, talent scouts, heaps of people that talk about the acting process and help to break down those barriers that we talk about for actors, and this idea of community is right throughout the whole website.
It comes back to that.
Yeah. So there's plenty of goodies too. I mean, there's a blog, there's an opportunity to be viewer of the month, which is great exposure for actors. And right now, if you share the trailer, and there's a few other things you have to do, but there's an opportunity to win $5,000 worth of acting scholarship. So that is huge.
And so for our show recommendation this month, I'd like to mention the upcoming season of Cain and Abel at the Belvoir Theatre that opens on the 15th.
Yep.
It's a show developed by The Rabble, which is a collection of artists who formed in 2006, originally Sid Brisbane, Kate Davis and Emma Valenti. I think there's a few
Sid other. Brisbane, what a name. It's like, I thought it was going to be, you were saying where it was
in
playing.
Sydney or Brisbane.
Yeah, correct. Right
now. I mean, there's a few other core cast members, but they've produced a number of works in Melbourne and Sydney, and it's really experimental, surreal, ambitious, original work.
Love it.
They do some great stuff. They performed the acclaimed and Green Room Awarded, the story of I Was Part of Neon last year. I didn't manage to catch that, but I did see the beautiful and confronting, that's my little review, Interactive Room of Regret for the Melbourne Festival.
Yes.
And so now they're about to open this production of Cain and Abel.
Great.
And they've taken the tale from Genesis and its many iterations, Milton and Byron, Baudelaire, and looked at it from the perspective, how different would our world be if the first act of violence was committed by a woman? What if Cain and Abel were actually sisters? If you're Sydney-based or you're traveling to Sydney this month, that is my hot tip. You can check it out on the Belvoir website, and of course, we'll put up a link.
So that is it for this month. Next month, we are going to change it up completely, Lauren.
Are we?
Yeah, we are. Woo. Yeah, we are. I'm just telling you now. We're going to look at storytelling from a completely different angle with a creative director. Paul Edwards is his name. Paulie. I can vouch personally that this guy is a wizard and he could sell snow to the Eskimo.
So as always, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and check out the About Me page for all the latest updates and previous episodes. Remember to hit us up on any of these forms to provide feedback and let us know anything you think we could do to make the show better.
True, true. And continue to join us on the act of storytelling.